These Sundays, when I am privileged to join you for worship, we're looking at the letter of James, Jesus' younger brother, the person who gave leadership to the Christian church in Jerusalem from its start until well on into its establishment, who was the one who oversaw and presided at that gathering in Acts 15 when the question was, can Gentiles be Christians alongside of Jews without first becoming Jews? And the answer was definitely yes. About that time, James sent this letter to the churches scattered around the Mediterranean world. Not too many places yet, Antioch, some places in what we call Turkey today, but then Asia Minor. A few other spots, probably Alexandria, Egypt by this time as well. We're going to pick up James' letter in chapter 2, starting at verse 14. James is so practical. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if a person claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save him or her? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to him, "Go, I wish you well, keep warm and well fed," but does nothing about his physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. But someone will say, "You have faith, I have deeds." Well, show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by what I do. You believe that there is one God. Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. You foolish person. Do you want evidence that faith without deeds is useless? Was not our ancestor Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? You see that his faith and his actions were working together, and his faith was made complete by what he did. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. And he was called God's friend. You see that a person is justified by what he does and not by faith alone. In the same way, was it not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? As the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. Charles Darwin. There's a good way to begin a sermon in a Christian church, right? Charles Darwin. We all know of Charles Darwin. He grew up in a Christian home, and during his investigations into the natural world, increasingly became disillusioned with the presumptions he had been taught in the church. It ended eventually with him not so much rejecting the Christian faith, but considering it to be somewhat irrelevant and many of its teachings to be inconclusive or contradictory to the way that he had perceived the world to operate. We could have debates on that for hours, but I'd kind of like to go home after a while, and maybe you would too. So let's leave that for another time in another place. It was during Charles Darwin's travels with the HMS Beagle, particularly around South America and the Galapagos Islands, that Charles Darwin began to assess the changes and the mutations and the nuances of difference that were present in different cultures, in different fauna and flora, animal world, this plant world, all of that. Way at the tip of South America was a place that was called Tierra del Fuego, the land of fires, because the ships that passed by saw many fires on the land and the islands just to the north of them. It was a dangerous place, one of the most dangerous shipping channels in the world then as well as now. The HMS Beagle passed through some of the islands and, in fact, gave its name to one of those that's called the Beagle Passage today. The southernmost city, outpost, large town in South America, on this continent, these two continents, North and South America, is a place called Ushuaia. It's a rather interesting place that I was privileged to visit some years ago. And while I was there, there was a group that was celebrating. They had come from England. They had come to celebrate the success of what they called the South American Mission, SAM. That was their notation for it. You see, Christians in England had tried a number of times to organize mission efforts in different places, including the Patagonia mission, Patagonia being southern South America. And five times over, it did not work. What happened was that all of those who were sent as missionaries were killed. And that brought an end to the missions. And the South African Mission Society in London decided that they would try one more time. They tried on the basis of one person who was very devoted to this work, who had served for a while as chair of the organization, and who had, among others, other children, an adoptive son who was extremely gifted in learning languages and picking up linguistics and the way that people communicate. This young fellow was named Thomas. Now, his last name was not the same as that of his adopted family. Because here's the story. His father had been a pastor in Bristol, England, in the mid-1800s. And while he was walking home late one night, he heard the crying of a baby. It was near a bridge in Bristol. And when he went to look at where this baby cry was coming from, there was a baby wrapped up and on the ground. He picked up the child, looked for a mother, a father, a parent, a guardian, someone, and there was none to be found. He took the child home, and rather than having it go into other forms of social care, he and his wife adopted this baby. It happened to be on St. Thomas's day in the liturgical calendar of the year, so they called him Thomas. And since he'd been found near a bridge, they wanted to give him an independent name, and they called him Thomas Bridges. Thomas Bridges had a great facility for learning language and understanding how people communicated. And Thomas Bridges was the sixth and last hope for the Patagonian mission, the South American mission as it came to be known. And he and his family, his parents, they eventually left and went back to England, but they went all to South America. And there they founded a place called Ushuaia. And they had the ability to connect with the people before the people ate them. These were cannibals. They managed to do that because of young Thomas. He was in his teens at the time, but he had such a facility with communication that he quickly picked up on the language of the Yamuna Indians, or native peoples, shouldn't really be called Indians. There were six different groups in that area, and the Yamuna were the most prominent. And before long, young Thomas was able to connect with them and speak to them about life and meaning and God. Within a short order, it was through Thomas Bridges that these people changed from their previous ways and outlook and worldview and became Christians. Why is that so significant? These were the very people that, when Charles Darwin sailed on the HMS Beagle, they were warned to stay away from. And part of Darwin's perspective on what happens to life on planet Earth, the survival of the fittest and the death of the rest, was related to the fact that nothing could change or alter the way that civilizations were unfolding by natural selection, by natural order, and by the innate character of humankind. Charles Darwin continued to maintain contact with those who were sailing around these areas and to receive new specimens for his collections. And he was so, I dare say, unnerved to find out that these savages, not at all like the civilized English people, these savages had changed their ways. He was dumbfounded about that, to the extent that he began to support the mission work of the South American Mission Society, the only Christian agency that he supported from his early years until his dying day. Charles Darwin supported Thomas Bridges' work in South America because Charles Darwin couldn't figure out how things could change like that. He was glad for it. That's a little bit of what James is trying to say to us. Charles Darwin had heard plenty of people say, "I have faith, you should have faith too." Yeah, right. But Thomas Bridges lived his faith in such a way that it brought transformation to a society and to a culture. It actually changed people. It made them different. There are a couple of things that James calls on us to think about as he keeps that before us. What exactly is it that faith and works are about in the day-to-day activities of those who call themselves sisters and brothers of Jesus? John Calvin noted that there were two words that were conjoined, you might say, in talking about faith: assentia and fiducia, right? Assent and trust. You are sitting on benches, and you trust those benches to support your weight. You trusted them before you sat down, and then you sat down. Assent is looking at a room full of benches and saying, "I believe those benches will hold my weight." Trust is sitting in those benches. One is intellectual knowledge. The other is personal action on that intellectual knowledge. And James points us to two people from the history of the faith that he knows and loves and has participated since his earliest thoughts. One of those, of course, is great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy Abraham. He's the father of us all the Jewish people. It was through Abraham that the Hebrew nation, eventually called the Israelites, would come into being. And it was a miracle that it happened, wasn't it? I mean, Abram and Sarai were good people, and they were rich people, and they were looked after well because they had the wherewithal to get the medical attention they needed even as they aged. And they hoped and prayed for a child, and a child didn't come. And then one day, they got the message: "You can have a baby." Sarai laughed. "Can't be too old for that." And so they acted on their belief and disbelief. And Sarai had a young slave girl. And Sarai said, "I'm too old." You might be somewhat virile yet. And they produced a son. And Sarai claimed him, Hagar, Ishmael. And the message came, "Yeah, nice try, not the way it's going to be. You two, Abram and Sarai, are going to have a baby together. It's getting a little long for that. Eventually, by the time Sarai became pregnant, she was 90 years old. Looking for a baby boom? Abraham was young, only 100. You know what they called the name of the baby? Laughter. What a joke! A good joke! A good joke! That's what Isaac means. Laughter. They were so pleased, so happy. That kid was so spoiled. They were the parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents all rolled into one. And man, Isaac got it all. Even sent his half-brother out, you know, Hagar, Ishmael, get out of here, we got to preserve place and space for Isaac. So Isaac grew, and every time they saw Isaac, they smiled. They laughed. Laughter. His name meant everything. And then one day, the voice came to Abraham again. The voice said, take your son, your only son, your son Laughter, and go kill him as a sacrifice. And Abraham's heart was completely twisted. We believe. We trust. We have faith. But some things are beyond belief. Some things are too incredible for understanding and acting upon. No, 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 no. And yet, Abraham knew this was the call, the command, and the only way that anything had happened before was for him to act on his faith. Now, I don't like this, and I don't want to be called into this situation. We have three daughters. They happen to be the three best people in the entire world. You want to see pictures? I'll show you. After our middle daughter gave birth to her second child, she died. She died and she died and she died. She died three times. Medically, she died. They called her life. They terminated her existence. They put it down in the reports. They were walking out of the hospital room where she had just died for the second time, when she sat up miraculously, bolt upright in the bed where they had just called her dead, she said, this isn't going very well, and she flopped over into a coma. I'm so thankful, and I'm so torn. How many times haven't I sat in hospital rooms and prayed for healing for others? And here, beyond all hope, we had prayed for it, sure, but three times over in three different days, she died and came back to life. And the writer of Hebrews says that Abraham believed it was possible that God could bring Isaac back from the dead. And I guess that's what I would linger in hope on. And yet, go take your child, the laughter of your life, and snuff it out. Wow. We remember the rest of the story, though, don't we? Genesis 22. You see, Abraham had had promises from God before this. In fact, there are four of them, three before this. Genesis 12, Genesis 13, Genesis 15, and then again Genesis 17. In Genesis 12, I'm going to bless all the nations of the world through you, and I'm going to give you a land. Genesis 13, I'm going to bless all the nations of the world through you, and I'm going to give you land. Genesis 15, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to give you a child. Genesis 17, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to give you a child. Three of those promises are what we call royal grants. What's a royal grant? It's when someone in Washington, D.C. says the economy is going bad, we're going to send you a check. You say, what do I have to do? No, don't. We're going to send you a check. You can do with it whatever you want. Check out Genesis 12, what happens when Abram is promised a land. The first story after that is Abraham leaves the land. He thinks it's not good enough for him. Genesis 13, he fights over the land, thinking he has to reclaim his own. Genesis 15, Sarai and Abraham connive with Hagar to get a child. Finally, there's a change. In Genesis 17, there's what we call a suzerain vassal grant or covenant. In Genesis 12, 13, and 15, it's a gift. There you go. Do with it what you will. In Genesis 17, it's a reciprocal commitment. I will do, but I call you to act as well. And this is what James is getting at. When is this story about Abraham told? It's told when the people of Israel are at Mount Sinai. And what's happening at Mount Sinai is that Yahweh is making a covenant with Israel. But it's not a royal grant. Here you go. Here you go. Throw another towel out there. T-shirt at a ball game. Paper towels to those who've been affected by the hurricane. Throw it out there. What a great gift. It's a reciprocal grant. I will do, but I expect you to act. And there, says James, is where faith was proved. Not in receiving gifts from God, but in receiving gifts from God in which we are called to respond and participate. Essentia, fiducia. I believe those benches can hold my body. I will sit down in those benches and act upon it. Crazy thing is that God then said, you know, I'm not the kind of God who demands that pound of flesh and that human sacrifice. And the place where this all took place is called Mount Moriah, Genesis 22. Fascinating thing about this is that that name will come back. Moriah is one of those words in the Hebrew language. We have active, we have passive. I did this, it was done to me. In the Hebrew language, there's a middle voice where both action and passivity are both combined into one thing, the middle voice. And Moriah is one of those middle voice words where it means both God sees and God is seen. Because actions accompany trust. And people are involved. And what happens on Mount Moriah? That another sacrifice is provided, and Isaac, laughter, laughs all the way home again. But what about this place? In the book of Chronicles, we're told that when David wanted to build the temple, God had been traveling with God's traveling people in the tabernacle, but now God's traveling people were settled in the nation. And now David said, God should have a permanent house as well. And Nathan the prophet said, bless you, my son, go ahead and do it. And then that night Nathan had a vision he needed to communicate the next day. He said, wait a minute, it's not for you, it's for your son. You are a man of war, your hands are bloody, your son a man of peace. Shalom, Solomon will be the one who establishes this. But David got everything prepared, including the location. And what was the location? Oh, that traveled down, because high places don't change for years or decades or centuries. Where was the place? We're told in Chronicles the place was Moriah, where God sees, where God will be seen. Now think about that. Abraham about 2000 BC, David, Solomon about 1000 BC, the temple is raised there. What happens 1000 years later? Everything we've been thinking about, singing about, talking about this morning. Another father, another son walked up that same place, and on that same mountain called Moriah, this time the son was sacrificed, so that we need not be. Do you believe it? Do you trust it? Do you act on it? Often you wonder why tears come into your eyes and burdens seem to be much more than you can stand. But God is standing near. He sees your fallen tears. Tears are a language God understands. And then James gives us a second illustration of faith, the illustration of Rahab. We know her from one brief chapter, Joshua chapter 2. Before the Israelites enter the promised land, they send two spies in. The next major city just across the river is Jericho, and they go and they spend time. Where better to know what's going on than with someone who has actually got the ear and the tongue of nearly every male, upper class male in town, prostitute. So Rahab saves the spies, and she sends them free again, and she's saved in herself in the end. But why is this so significant? Prostitution in those days is not like we think of prostitution. People who maybe walk the streets late at night or are escorts in a call service or whatever. Prostitution was very much alive and well in every Near Eastern city, village, hamlet, you name it. Because prostitution was part of an agrarian society. You know, it's too bad. So few of us are farmers. Isn't that terrible? There was a day when the human race was a mighty race, and we were farmers, and we grew our food. Now all we know is mire. We have no attachment to how foods actually come to us. But in an agrarian society, people watch the clouds, not just for beach days, not just for spring break, but for weather and changes in climate and the seasons and that kind of thing. And in an agrarian society, what you need to do is to get those seeds to grow and those animals to produce. It's a living entity and reality. We always had little vegetable gardens for our daughters when we moved from city to city, because both my wife and I grew up on farms. We wanted them to know that things don't just come from the grocery store. And one of our daughters was so thrilled with this that every couple of minutes she would dig up that bean seed again just to see if it was growing. No, you can't do that. You can't do that. Can't do that. You need to be in tune with the growth and the seasons and all of that. And what better way to do that than to live it out in your own life? And that's why there was prostitution. Because every male farmer, and that's like 99.9% of the people, the males, every male farmer had to participate in this whole cycle of birth and rebirth. And so there were shrines to the local gods who would bless the people and bless the fields and bless the crops and bless the animals. And every farmer would go to those shrines to have sex with a prostitute as part of the fertility rituals. I'm glad we didn't live in that society. My dad was an honest and good man, true to my mom all his life. But now you understand Rahab. She's not just a prostitute. She is an agent for the gods of the land. Her life is sold out to and committed to the sustaining of the local deity system. These gods will bring fertility to us and to our plants and our fields and our crops and our animals. And we participate in the fertility rites. And what do we find in Joshua chapter 2? It is Rahab who says to the spies, "We know that your God is God in heaven and on earth. That your God is not just a tribal God belonging to your community. Your God is the true God, not just for your people, but for us as well." And she acted on her belief, and she changed her religion and her behaviors. And she saved the spies who were in danger from the local authorities of corrupting their good religion. Actions. Do you believe it? Do you act on it? Kind of interesting, some years ago, Fred Craddock, who used to teach preaching at Candler School of Theology at Emory University in Atlanta, he and his wife were traveling through eastern Tennessee, and they stopped one evening at a restaurant that they thought would be a nice place to spend some hours looking out over a valley in the Great Smoky Mountains. It was called the Black Bear Inn, and one side of the restaurant was completely glass covered so that it was possible if they looked long enough and hard enough, they might see one of those black bears over there. They hoped to. They were by themselves. They wanted a little time away from the city. They wanted some quiet. And just as they began to eat, a tall man with a wonderful white shock of hair on his head came over with a booming voice and said to them, "Hey, how are you doing? Good to have you here." And Fred wanted to get rid of him in the worst way. And he said, "What do you do for a living?" And Fred knew what he could say. "I'm a preacher." "Oh, is that ever good? Yeah, I know preachers. Preachers are good people." "Hey, I grew up back in these hills," he said. "I grew up and my mom was shamed. I did not know who my father was and my mother never married. And every time we came to town, we would walk the streets and people would look at us and they'd look at me and they tried to figure in my face who I belonged to. Who was my real daddy? My mama would take my hand and we'd cross the street and we'd go to the other side. We weren't going to be there for that. When I went to school, I was shamed every day. The other kids laughed at me. When it came recess time, I would hide in the weeds. When we had our lunch, I took it by myself and sat behind the tree. When I was about eighth grade, a new preacher came to the church in town, and he fascinated me and he terrified me all at the same time. He thundered from that pulpit, and I could not stay away. My mama would not go to church. She was shamed in this town, but I was really attracted to him. I wouldn't go at the start of the service. I wouldn't go when the other people were milling around. I went late. Just slipped in the back door. I listened to him and he thundered and he moved my soul and he shook my heart. But every time when he finished, I was quick out the door, not going to get caught by these people. One day it happened. One day when I was just getting ready to leave, the women's choir was going to sing and they lined up in the back of the church and they blocked my exit. I couldn't go nowhere. I was trapped. And suddenly I knew somebody was going to do this. A big hand clamped itself down on my shoulder And a man turned me around fiercely. And he stooped and he looked in my face, and it was that preacher. That preacher that I was attracted to and that thundered and scared me. He looked in my face. He said, "Who are you, boy? Who are you, boy? Let me see now. I think I see the family resemblance. Yeah, I can see it in your face. You're a son of. And I knew my face was bright red. All of the anguish of my soul was. You're a son of your Father in heaven. He swatted me on the behind and sent me out the door. And then the man walked away from the table. And Nettie said to Fred, "Who was that?" And Fred thought for a minute, and then he said, "I think that was Ben Hooper. Ben Hooper." Twice over, the good people of the state of Tennessee elected a bastard, illegitimate child to be their state governor, one of the best ever. He acted on his identity. He found his faith and made it real. Do you believe? Yeah, right. Prove it. Pray with me.